Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. COVID-19 tore through Maryland's prisons. More than 4,300 inmates at state facilities have tested positive for the virus over the past year. 26 have died. The risk isn't just to those behind bars. Over 2,000 correctional officers have contracted COVID since last March. Ryan King is Director of Research and Policy for the Justice Policy Institute, a national nonprofit that advocates for criminal justice reform and policies aimed at reducing incarceration. He and Dr. Chris Byrer, a Johns Hopkins epidemiologist, recently called for increased COVID testing in prisons in a commentary in the Baltimore Sun. Ryan King, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We know that congregate living spaces allow for the easy spread of this virus. Why else are people living in prison vulnerable to COVID?
One of the things that we've been taught, one of the many things we've been taught helps reduce the spread for all of us sort of out in the general population, right, is social distancing, wearing a mask, and all the number of steps that you can take to sort of protect yourself above and beyond ultimately getting the vaccine, and frankly, even after you get the vaccine. And so obviously in prisons, it's a very different situation. These are individuals that have very little autonomy over their day-to-day interactions. They don't have the ability to run to the store to get more masks, to get cleaning supplies or other personal protective equipment. They're at the mercy of the administrators within the prisons. I think there is an absolute sort of obligation and burden upon the state to ensure that those individuals are protected, particularly since they are unable to do things like, for example, social distance in prison. They are highly congregate settings, as you mentioned. Individuals are stacked together and are not able to take the preventative steps that other people out in the general public are, and thus that really raises the urgency for administrators to take protective steps seriously.
The State Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services, DPSCS, reports that more than 66,000 inmates have been tested for COVID during the pandemic. Why do you think more testing is needed?
Looking back over the past year, there's been sort of an up and down experience in Maryland. Actually, sort of early on, a little about a year ago now, undertook a really extensive, comprehensive testing process and tested everybody in the prison and both staff and those incarcerated. And they completed that by the early summer, which was terrific. The problem was, as we saw, the numbers actually in Maryland did not spike in the way we had seen in other jurisdictions. But into the fall, we continued to monitor the data that the state provided, and we began to see increases in specific facilities. And I think what was particularly alarming to us was, in weekly reports, we began to see 100% positivity rates among both staff and incarcerated individuals. And the story that's telling you then, if you have 100% positivity, you're not doing sort of proactive testing at that point. Obviously, at that point, you're simply testing individuals who are reporting some type of symptom. And if that's the case, as we know, that's far too late to stem the spread. So particularly in congregate care settings, testing, and more testing is the only way to identify and prevent spread. And we saw the positivity rates begin to increase in November, and then the spread of the virus increased quite significantly into the new year. And you mentioned that written an op-ed, JPI and others in the state really began to try to draw attention, particularly to certain facilities out by Hagerstown, an Eastern Correctional Institution that began to see spikes of hundreds of individuals testing positive after being relatively flat for a significant period of time. Fortunately, in recent weeks and months, it's evident in the data the state's provided that the rates of testing have gone up significantly and the positivity rates have declined, commensurate with the declines we've seen in the state overall. So, as I said, I think the state started out well. They lost a little bit of focus along the way, but I'm hopeful now that as we see more proactive testing, that they're moving in the right direction. But that's something they have to continue to stay on until everybody within those facilities are vaccinated.
You're also worried about the spread of COVID from prisons to the outside community.
Of course. I mean, for the individuals who are incarcerated, that's one population. But as you mentioned, we've got thousands of staff that come in and out of the prison in any given day. And looking nationally beyond Maryland, Most of the biggest hotspots in the country for COVID infections over the past year have either been in prisons, and almost all of them in prisons, frankly, a handful in some meatpacking plants. And we began to see in places like Ohio, for example, spikes in the surrounding community, which you would expect if individuals are going in, there's limited PPE, they come back out, they're home with their families or in communities. The spread of the virus is substantial. So you have staff coming in and out in any given day. And then, of course, individuals are released from prison when they finish up their term, rather paroled or in Maryland and ultimately released. And for those individuals as well, if they're leaving an area with high rates of viral spread, they run the risk returning to the community of beginning to spread that among their neighbors and family members.
That's Ryan King. On the Record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. He's Director of Research and Policy for the nonprofit Justice Policy Institute and recently wrote an op-ed published in the Baltimore Sun about the need for increased COVID-19 testing in Maryland's prisons. The Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services declined to make anyone available for this interview, but they did provide a written statement. Part of that statement reads, quote, "The department continues testing and vaccinating aggressively in accordance with the state-sanctioned priority groups as outlined in Maryland's phased COVID-19 vaccination distribution plan." Quote, "Inmates vaccinated so far include those age 16 and older whose health conditions place them within health department guidelines for priority vaccinations. The department is not mandating staff or inmate vaccinations," close quote. As of last week, of course, everyone over age 16 in Maryland will be eligible to be vaccinated. According to the DPSCS COVID-19 dashboard, 1,474 inmates have received their first dose, and 772 are fully vaccinated. What do you make of the speed of vaccination?
I mean, this is tricky, right? I think Maryland did a wonderful job of prioritizing those individuals who were incarcerated as well as staff early on in early phases. Not every state did that, so kudos to the state for that. Unfortunately, the way it was rolled out was ultimately not that everybody, as you mentioned, in prison was immediately eligible, but phased in similar along the way it was phased in among the general community. And I think that's a problem because regardless of your, certainly individuals with risk factors should be prioritized, but all individuals who are in prison are frankly at risk just by virtue of being incarcerated and should have been prioritized. But you have hit on something that I think is critically important, which is there's making the vaccine available, and then there's having individuals who are willing to be vaccinated. This is also an ongoing conversation in the broader community as it is within prisons, both among staff and incarcerated individuals. Over 70% of the Maryland's prison system are people incarcerated in Maryland's prison are Black. They are a population of individuals who we've actually had conversations and communicate with folks incarcerated who've expressed real skepticism and concern about the vaccine, about the safety of it. You would frequently hear people bring up the Tuskegee experiments and concerns about basically trusting leadership and administration. And so I think in addition to getting vaccines available, there really is a public education campaign that's necessary that the state needs to undertake. And that is with both individuals incarcerated as well as with staff. Not all staff are willing and interested in being vaccinated. And that's going to be a real problem. And I think the state needs to put forth a plan on how they're going to address this issue. The numbers that I've seen are we still have, you know, you mentioned 1,474. So they've actually doubled first dose last week. So they are increasing the availability, but this is a fraction of individuals who are incarcerated in the state. And I think they really need to develop a plan, need to reach out to real credible messengers, individuals that have some level of credibility with those incarcerated. But personally, I think that is a real important priority right now is vaccine availability, one, but 1A is also making sure that folks are educated on the safety and importance of getting themselves vaccinated, both for their own health as well as the individuals in the prison and the broader community.
How have other states tackled the vaccination process for people living in prisons and jails?
Well, frankly, it's been either similar to Maryland or worse. So this is a case of that we don't have a lot of good examples. As I mentioned, I think Maryland stood out as one of the states that did a wonderful job of prioritizing, but the implementation has not necessarily been where we needed to be. But there are other states where, you know, New York just had recent litigation to get certain individuals vaccinated. So there are other states where there has been a real sort of obstacles to getting individuals who are in prison vaccinated. So it, unfortunately, probably not a lot of surprise to your listeners, has been troublesome and problematic and slow. And that is why organizations like ourselves and others in Maryland and elsewhere are really trying to draw attention to the issue to continue to put light on it. As you know, many people now have been vaccinated. It's springtime. People are ready to get back to their lives and get back to normalcy. And I think that we're at a real dangerous moment where some folks may want to move on and forget that there are a lot of vulnerable individuals out there who have not been vaccinated or are still unsafe.
Ryan, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for drawing attention to this really important issue.
Ryan King is Director of Research and Policy for the nonprofit Justice Policy Institute. We have a link to the Baltimore Sun op-ed he co-authored with Hopkins physician Chris Byrer at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. Quick break now. When we're back, how a public defender advocates for his clients during the pandemic. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Imagine getting arrested in 2019. Being held in jail without bail, and having your trial date in 2020 postponed indefinitely. Here we are in 2021, and you're still awaiting a day in court. That's how Todd Oppenheim, a supervising attorney in the Baltimore City Public Defender's Office, opens the op-ed he wrote in January about how the pandemic brought the justice system to a halt. He's written several pieces over the past year describing what it's like to represent clients during the pandemic and his concern for their health behind bars. Todd Oppenheim, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Sheila.
How has the pandemic affected your ability to communicate with your clients?
The pandemic has kind of completely upended our model or mode of representation. And for all the hardships that we have, they pale in comparison to what our clients are going through that are incarcerated, and even the people that are not incarcerated that have pending matters that just can't be resolved, they're the ones that are struggling. We'll get by, but we are having extreme difficulties, and it weighs on us personally because of the investment that we have in our job, our profession. So it affects us basically in the way that we normally go to the office, just like anyone else. But we're extremely collaborative as public defenders, and I think a lot of attorneys operate that way. The courts, obviously, are completely different and pretty much remote in Baltimore City. And then you have the jail system where we would normally go and meet with clients and the way they're housed. So all three of those are really completely different. It's unprecedented.
What are you hearing from your clients about conditions in jail, in prison?
Well, they sound horrible. Plenty of my clients have been diagnosed with COVID. My colleagues are hearing the same thing. And to hear a recent client that was diagnosed and has since come back from quarantining is really just putting someone in isolation, which has historical implications of just really a not a good environment to put anybody in. I mean, you're already jailed, and to isolate people creates all sorts of psychological issues. These people are all pre-trial too, but the recent client talked about 23 hours a day within a cell, not being able to go out because of the quarantining. And then you come out and you're just thrown back into the jail. It's a question of, into like a dormitory kind of group environment. It's a question of, have you really healed? And then they give you back the same mask that you've had, you know, for the prior 2 months of your stay in jail. It's a scary situation for a lot of our clients that are stuck.
Maryland's courts closed to the public last March and have gradually resumed activities. A return to full operations is expected at the end of this month. What difference does it make whether you and your client are physically versus virtually present before a judge?
Well, it means everything. I personally have experienced some Zoom proceedings, which is just mind-blowing before the pandemic, but now it's somewhat understandable, but it should never be accepted. There are fundamental rights to the justice system, and those are to be present, obviously, for your proceedings. Your liberty is on the line. It's for so many reasons. I mean, when you're remote, we're not in the same physical location as our clients, so we can't communicate privately with them. If you're on a Zoom call, they will allow breakout rooms, and you get that. But the instantaneous interaction, the comfort that we can provide a client when going through a serious proceeding, you lose all of that when you're remote. You don't have that privacy. You also don't have the same public access for family. Judges have been reluctant to let people on the Zoom call that they're not familiar with, which is really problematic to us and potentially violate of the Constitution, in that everybody has a right to a public trial. And a huge thing is the right to confrontation. And everybody thinks of that as like the right to see and face your accuser. And that doesn't necessarily mean somebody that was a direct victim of your crime. Oftentimes, especially in Baltimore City, that's the police. And what is the reason that we want all that is to challenge the credibility of a witness that's testifying against you in these serious matters. So all of that is really, it's just this completely new dynamic with remote court. And it's been optional, but as you were saying, that these periods of incarceration, pre-trial that people are going through, they really weigh on us, they weigh on our clients, and it makes this consideration that we would never have to do this stuff remotely, it makes it a more viable option, because people just want to be heard. They want a day in court. They want to be able to argue something.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Baltimore City Public Defender Todd Oppenheim about how the pandemic has affected his clients and his work to represent them. Last spring, the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services announced it released more than 2,000 incarcerated individuals in order to slow the spread of coronavirus. And Governor Hogan signed executive orders last April and in November to expedite the release of elderly inmates and those nearing release who have not committed violent crimes. You wrote a piece published in Salon about an elderly client of yours who would not have qualified for release. What do you make of Maryland's approach to expedited release during the pandemic?
Well, it's not enough. First of all, everything that you were referring to deals with people who have been convicted and are serving sentences. So for people who are pending cases, that's the majority of our work as they call them line attorneys, as public defenders in courts in the city. We're representing people that are presumed innocent that haven't gone to trial yet. So those early release possibilities are set up for people that are in prisons, which is kind of backwards, you would think, because those people have already been found to have committed their offenses either through a plea or through a trial. But we're not working to the same extent for people that are pre-trial. And in terms of the people that are serving sentences, like the client that I wrote about, there's kind of this blanket, and the legislators seem to do this with everything. There's this blanket prohibition and kind of outcry against so-called violent offenses, which is a very broad definition. Certainly, they are more serious crimes, but they often encapsulate things that, when you look into it, you would say, well, the charge itself seems serious and could be considered violent. But this individual, this circumstance, this needs a different look. And the way these provisions are set up with these early releases and these special medical situations for COVID, they don't make special exceptions. They didn't make one for my client, who's this 73-year-old man, who's charged with a gun offense. But when you look at it, when you have a victim who wanted my client out of jail, you had a situation where he didn't have a record before the offense. you would think, oh, this is an exception we can make, but there aren't exceptions.
You have written about COVID drawing out the criminal justice process, forcing many to wait in jail while the court appearances were postponed. How backed up are your cases?
It's becoming startling and very problematic for the attorneys that I supervise and work with, and of course our clients. It's a bottleneck. There is no ability until April 26th to have a jury trial throughout the state, and that's essentially been on hold since Thanksgiving. And so when you cut off our ability as trial attorneys, that's what we are as public defenders. We try cases. We try the majority of them in the city. We have negative misconceptions in terms of our image, but we're the ones in trial. And when you cut off that ability, and the same thing goes for private attorneys too, you take away our leverage in the system. So the state controls the process. You know, they demand an offer for a plea, and we have no recourse. We can't say, well, we don't want that. We would rather assert our rights and proclaim our innocence and argue our defense. You can't do it. So people don't want to plead guilty to offenses that they didn't commit or for unjust sentences. The judges aren't necessarily working with us to fashion a sentence that would be, agreeable to everyone. And cases are just getting postponed. You know, even with the reopening of courts, there's only so much of a speed that things can work at. So the cases keep piling up. Our attorneys are getting stressed and they really are invested in their job. So it is really difficult on them. It weighs personally.
What should be done to fix this?
Well, we would hope that the court would get involved more. There are different jurisdictions that have kind of opened up so-called plea courts, where we go in and in times when courts are open, you go up to the bench. It's the time where the general public can't hear what's going on, and you fashion a resolution that's agreeable to everyone. Some of the cases that we have are really close to that. We just can't get over the edge. And, you know, it's our job to do the best we can for a client. So when we don't see possibility of a good resolution for them, we're going to wait for a trial, whenever that is. And if that's what they want, then that's what we're going to do. It's really frustrating to tune in to the Derek Chauvin trial, for instance, and to see that court is taking place in different parts of the country, the federal system, Minnesota, Texas, and to see the protections that are in place and the ease with which they're able to work around COVID. And meanwhile, we're stuck in this holding pattern where stuff isn't getting done. So, yeah, there's protections that have to be made. People are getting vaccinated. You know, a lot of our attorneys have been able to do that. We hope the prosecutors are able to do it. The judges certainly have been vaccinated. Our clients, of course, pretrial are not vaccinated at this point. Only people who are serving sentences are. But there needs to be a push to resolve cases and to really open up the courts in a more efficient and safe manner.
How has the pandemic pointed out challenges people with low incomes face as they move through the criminal justice system?
Well, it's no different than so many other aspects of the pandemic in that it just highlights the inequities in the classes that we have. Our clients are indigent people. As public defenders, that's who we represent. So many of them have been afforded we generally have been able to get into court and argue bail reviews. That's something that the court has been really open to and has really worked to get a lot more bail reviews scheduled that it would have never happened pre-COVID. So they're reevaluating people's status pre-trial to see whether they should be in jail. And one of the more prevalent options that wasn't there before, it was there but not used by judges, is home detention. In Baltimore City, for instance, home detention is only is predominantly, I should say, through private companies that cost money. And so when you think about that in terms of an indigent defendant, you're starting to get towards the bail system that we have already reformed and kind of moved away from. But it is a kind of pay-to-play sort of a deal where obviously people with money that can afford it have it more readily available as an option, where we don't for a lot of our indigent clients. Judges are getting open to it, and let's not make any bones about it. We would prefer, you know, release with supervision with pretrial agents where people can be in the community, but anything is better than being in an institution at this point.
Todd, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Todd Oppenheim is a supervising attorney in the Baltimore City Public Defender's Office. At the On the Record page at WYPER.org, we've got links to some of the opinion pieces he's written during the pandemic. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're with us on the record. Join us again tomorrow.
For listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.